This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Hartford and Bridgeport aren't the only Connecticut towns with interesting races for mayor this year. How about our favorite little city of New London? Meanwhile, the mileage tax idea came and went more quickly than a megabus barreling down I-95, and the casino border war between Connecticut and Massachusetts is heating up. Those are just a few of the stories we'll be tackling in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. A little later, we'll also play a game of Where Are They Now with former members of Connecticut's congressional delegation who are all back making news in one way, shape, or form. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show, which you can hear weekdays at 1 p.m. on WNPR. Hello once again, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
And thank you for taking over the Wheelhouse last week in my absence.
It was a joy.
Also with us is Susan Bigelow. She's a columnist for ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello once again, Susan.
Good morning.
And David Collins is here. He's a columnist for The Day of New London. Hi there, David.
Good morning.
Let's start with this story that we're actually going to be turning to for an entire hour tomorrow on our program, and it has to do with Connecticut Department of Children and Families. An advocacy group is saying that Connecticut should close the two juvenile detention facilities run by DCF. Recent reports about conditions at the facilities found that young people in each of them were subjected to repeated and unlawful restraint and seclusion. The Connecticut Juvenile Justice Alliance calls the detention facilities prisons. Robert Francis is with the Alliance. He says that the facilities aren't environments where boys and girls with mental health issues can get the support services they need.
We still may need locked facilities for a certain group of young people who have committed pretty serious offenses for a period of time. But we're talking about smaller facilities closer to home with many more services available to them.
So this report that came out from the state's child advocate, Colin, that has prompted some changes already at DCF, it's prompted this advocacy organization to say it's time to close down these prisons. Now there's hearings at the state capitol. This is an ongoing story. It's something that's been happening for an awful long time, and it sort of takes us all back to the reckoning of building some facilities that probably weren't exactly right to start with and sort of have never been right since.
Right. So we have to say the R word now because, in fact, I mean, I know that it's a risky thing to get into the game of what can you blame on John Rowland, but you really do have to blame this on John Rowland.
We can
this
play was, that game too today if
right,
you like.
Right, yeah. This is the paradigmatic example of a corruptly built facility. It was really kind of, in some ways, this building almost was the star witness against him. It was built through collusion with contractors on a no-bid basis. And so what was missed was that underlying that was also Rowland's philosophy, which was this sort of get tough on everybody, except it turns out himself, philosophy that, you know, was sort of the same kind of thinking that made it okay to send prisoners to Wallen's Ridge and stuff like that. So this is – it was an inappropriate facility the day that it opened. And Jody Rell, when she took over, one of the early things she did was to announce that she was closing it. And it turns out it's like Guantanamo. It was like one thing to announce you're going to close
this before. Yeah.
I actually, for a while, thought it was closed. I don't drive down there and check. So she said she was closing it. And I thought it was closed. And I think I might have said that on the air or put it in a column. And Michael Lawler called me and said, oh, no, it's still open. Well, how can it still be open if the governor said she was closing it? Anyway, it's never been – it also just cuts against the grain of what we're thinking about in terms of justice reform, criminal justice reform, specifically juvenile justice reform nationally, all right? Okay, there's this national wave to stop hyper-criminalizing people. But this thing takes, you know, some pretty routine juvenile offender and treats him like he's Michael Ross.
So, Susan, again, this is a story that's been with us for so long. As Colin said, the new thing in America really is this fresh look at how we do not just juvenile justice, but justice across the board. And so is it perhaps time that the state, whether it's at the legislature, all across the board, we start to really say we don't need to throw kids in jail the way we've been doing it?
It's well past time. And this is something that's been going on in other states for quite some time, especially Missouri, which has really led the way towards taking kids out of these kinds of facilities and putting them into more community-based programs closer to home. Not these sort of locked prison-like facilities. And I know that the Juvenile Justice Alliance called this a prison, in which it sort of is but sort of isn't. It's the sort of – that doesn't know what it is, which is one of the problems that came up in the reports.
Well, is it locked and can you leave?
Exactly.
And that sounds like a prison, right?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. And I think with that report and also what came out from the state's child advocate, you get a sense that the state now needs to come to a reckoning of, on one hand, Governor Malloy's very progressive idea of a second chance society, about truly reforming the way criminal justice is done and meted out in the state, and what has been left for the juveniles.
Right. And the problem that I keep coming back to is that in this report that the Juvenile Justice Alliance put out, the reason why Governor Rell wanted to close this facility, the training school, was that there was a report by the then child advocate about abuses at that facility. And now here we are 10 years later, similar kind of stuff, another report, except now we're including the newly built girls' facility, which a lot of people said was also obsolete as soon as it was built. It just feels like in another 10 years, if we keep these places open, we're going to see the same kind of report, because what's going on is that these sorts of facilities, they are breeding grounds for this kind of abuse because of the way that they – the sort of power differential between the residents and the staff there. So really, these things, they need to close.
But so here's a question that always comes up, David, is we know that these aren't big facilities for hundreds and hundreds of kids. At maximum, you've got a couple dozen kids at either of these facilities at any time. And these are kids that have very difficult upbringings and backgrounds. They have faced an awful lot of physical and emotional, sometimes sexual trauma in their lives. But they also, it has been said, can cause potential harm or threat to others around them. There's no real good place to put them in the rest of the system. So the question is, if we don't have these prisons, where do they go?
That is a problem, and that is certainly the issue at hand. But I don't think that that's the reason to continue to keep this facility open. If the abuse is as chronicled and over a long period of time, then there needs to be you can't just look at the future problem, and you have to look at the direct problem and face it and close it.
So what exactly do we do with this, Colin? Because we've sort of been here before. We've had state oversight of the Department of Children and Families for a number of different reasons over time. Joette Katz is going to come on our program and talk a bit about how they've been adapting some of their principles, what they're trying to do in response to this report. Does this say something about juvenile prisons across America? Does this say something about specifically the way DCF has run this state prison? Or does it really, again, all get back to John Rowland and a prison that never should have been built?
Yeah, first of all, I don't know. I don't know that I necessarily have standing to pronounce on that question. I guess the things that I will say is that, I mean, once again, the tide in American criminal justice, there was some Texas official who said, think about this, this is Texas, as they started their prison reform movement, he said, you know, we really have to get back to that idea of releasing a better person than we took in. And if you look at the report that Susan's talking about right now, it doesn't seem like it would do that. In other words, you have, you know, just repeated use of restraints and all this kind of stuff. This is not probably going to ultimately result in a young person who's turned loose on the streets who's a better person than when in there. He may be more evasive and wary about getting caught and put back into something like that. So, I mean, that's got to be the goal. You know, in terms of DCF overarchingly, I will say that it's a problem that's nobody in Connecticut has ever solved in my adult lifetime. It was DCYS when I first became a reporter in 1976. That's what it was called then. And it was a mess then, and there were blue ribbon panels to try to fix it. And, I mean, everybody who's come in, every commissioner who's come in has been defeated, really. I mean, to my knowledge, there is no such thing as a successful Connecticut DCF or any of its antecedents. Commissioner. There just isn't one. And I don't entirely understand why that's the case. And I don't know if it's the same in every single state, like everybody just gets beaten down by these problems. Obviously, they're finely grained. They're just embedded in the rest of society. But I have more questions than answers about this.
It does seem like there's in other states that other similar agencies have been able to tackle this problem a little bit better. Again, Missouri is a national leader in this, and some of the things that they've done have really brought down the level of recidivism. They've really been able to have better outcomes than we've had here in Connecticut. But what it seemed to require in a lot of these places was a real change in the culture and a real sort of attention focused on the actual, on the agency. I mean, DCS problems, they come from all over the place. They come from the fact that they never have enough money. They're always stretched so thin. They're not really transparent. They just come from everywhere. So changing the culture of that place, while that sounds like an almost insurmountable thing, might be the place to start.
Let's move on to something else that has been a huge issue in Connecticut for years, and the governor is trying to take a crack at in this next term of his. He's made a big focus transportation, not only in this past legislative session, but throughout the course of his administration now. A steady stream of infrastructure improvements announced, including one this week. Molloy recently spoke near the Meriden intersection of I-91, I-691, and Route 15 to announce a reconfiguration of this area.
Gridlock highways and unreliable slow commutes are a long-term threat to the state's economic well-being.
And it seems as though what he's doing, Colin, is moving from place to place and pronouncing, we've got to change this interchange because, as anybody who's driven through that knows, it probably needs to be reconstituted. Whether or not he's down on the Gold Star Bridge down in David's part of the world or whether or not he's talking about the I-84 corridor through Hartford, the so-called Aetna Viaduct, he is essentially saying one after another, we've got to start working at this. Do you see a holistic pattern coming out of the Molloy administration around this?
I feel as though Susan and I are both waking up to Sonny and Cher singing I Got You, Babe. I mean, just like we just sat at these very seats and we have this conversation every time, which is that there really are some tried and true ways to deal with the kind of gridlock that he's talking about. But it's basically it's tolls and congestion pricing. You've got to make it expensive for people to be in a place where you don't want them to be. That sounds like a pretty simple concept, but I mean, it's a difficult one to implement, but until he's ready to talk about that, as far as I'm concerned, he's just talking.
Tolls and congestion pricing, this is a really important one, especially down in your neck of the woods, David. Whenever we talk about tolls, anyone who's anywhere near any borders starts to get a little bit nervous. I mean, what do you hear from people about the idea that we've got to start tolling some roads in order to pay for some of these infrastructure improvements?
Well, I think people are nervous about tolls, and yes, on the borders, you get more and more nervous about it. But I think that this is a good example of the fact that the governor's taking this up is a good example that he's really a Fairfield County governor. And he is keenly aware of the problems, and that's really where it's the worst. I mean, we see it in Hartford. I experienced some of the traffic this morning, but honestly, Fairfield County, almost all day, every day, it's just gridlock. And it's an important economic engine for the state, and Governor Molloy knows that as well as anyone. So I think that he's certainly he's addressed the problem. Whether, you know, what the solutions will be in tolls and, you know, taxes on everything that moves, as the Republicans would say about the GPS proposal for taxes. But, you know, something has to be done. He's absolutely right.
Yeah, there's talk, Susan, about a new way to pay for this 30-year transportation plan. It was called a mileage tax. We won't go into a lot of detail because the idea basically came and went very, very quickly. House Speaker Brendan Sharkey and Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff have already publicly opposed the idea. So this is one that, you know, just got enough attention for everyone to be upset about, and then it goes away. I mean, maybe this isn't the way to do it, but what is?
Well, the mileage tax is actually kind of interesting. This is the sort of they're experimenting with this out in the West, where instead of paying a gas tax, you pay they put something on your car, and per mile you drive, you get, you know, you have to pay a certain amount of money. So it's like every road becomes a toll road, and it's almost a disincentive to drive. It's interesting. I have no idea if it actually works because it's still in the trial phases. It's something that's worth talking about, though, if we want to shift people out of their cars onto public transportation, if we want to get cars off the highway. That's got to be part of it. But again, I don't know if that's actually going to work.
We actually got a tweet to Colin from Russell who asked about the mileage tax. He says, how much did the car hacking story contribute to the end of the mileage tax idea? It's actually a really interesting question because as we think about all this congestion pricing, there's this secondary tier of research and development in America around driverless cars, new technology that would completely transform the way we do everything. And I think some people might rightly think that the idea of taxing everywhere we drive, putting a transponder in our car, is really the first step toward a new world that looks a little bit more like that.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, there's a number of things here. So there's some technology that's already in place, right? I mean, tolls in other places are not the tolls that we remember from when Connecticut had tolls. I mean, it is something embedded in your windshield or, you know, a little rectangle that you've got that you hold up or whatever. And I mean, you're not stopping and all this kind of stuff. And then if you don't have it, somebody takes a picture of your car and gives you a ticket. I mean, that's already going on anywhere. Anytime you leave Connecticut, you're basically heading into that. So, but the mileage tax thing is kind of interesting to me on two different levels. One of them is I kind of doubt, given freedom-loving and highly paranoid America, that this is going to fly. It's going to probably be seen as the kind of automotive jade helm or something. But on the other hand, with highly regulated kinds of traffic, it could work. And that's in Central Europe and Eastern Europe, that's what's where it's working, is heavy trucks and stuff like that, because they already have to follow all kinds of rules that you and I don't have to. I mean, they're held more accountable. So my guess is it might work with anything like that, a kind of vehicle that's held more accountable. The one thing I do want to say is that I thought Sharkey and Duff were, I mean, if you're going to have a panel that's supposed to sort of really think about stuff like this, you know, running up and strangling stuff in its crib the minute anybody, you know, starts talking about it, it's sort of like the opposite of what I thought that panel was supposed to do, which was really talk about all the possibilities and maybe reject some. But just they're really kind of in a hurry to put a pillow over this thing.
Well, I will say, though, we thought that the pillow was placed over Keno many years ago, and, right. And Keno continues to haunt us in some way. Well, very, very quickly.
It's a simple and beautiful idea that, you know, you're paying for the amount of usage of the roads, and it's very simple, and the more you use it, the more tax you pay. It's sort of like a gas tax. But the notion that the government is going to have this transponder in your car and follow you everywhere, even though your cell phone is following you and there's all kind of data collection and people know there's all kinds of ways to follow you, I think it was maybe a good idea to smother that one at the outset and really focus on things that are going to fly, because it seems so obvious from the beginning. I mean, it landed as the tax everything that move proposal. I mean, it just wasn't going to fly. I guess I don't know. Move on to things that are really going to be necessary and taxes that are going to have to be paid to somehow finance.
Well, speaking of moving on, just quickly, but we'll go away from taxes and paying for the transportation. Just quickly ask you, David, if you were to ask people in your neck of the woods in the New London area about what's the big transportation thing that needs to be solved, what is it?
Personally, I think I'd like to see more train service. I mean, we Metro North goes to New Haven, then we get a connection through Shoreline East, and there's nothing then that takes you up to the Rhode Island border and connects up into Rhode Island. There's a great opportunity there for not a lot of money in terms of all the money that's being talked about here in terms of highway development, to connect, for our part of the world, to connect the shoreline up from Connecticut into Rhode Island, commuter train service. The rails are there. Just buy the cars and coordinate them, and it seems a pretty simple solution to make a lot of mass transportation available easily.
Now, Susan, you wrote an op-ed with the idea that some people have thought isn't going to get off the ground. This I-84 plan to remake the highway, you're actually talking about the tunnel proposal, which is probably going to be the most expensive proposal they could do through Hartford.
Right. But it's probably the best idea. This is the idea that has actually caught the public's imagination here in Hartford. Residents, they like this idea. Because you actually put the highway below ground, probably somewhere in the West End, it would go underground, and it would sort of come out where the Hartford quote unquote tunnel is now. But the reason why people like this idea is that you could actually reconnect the street grid above it, and you could put buildings, you could put parks, and the noise of the highway would be gone. The problem with I-84 right now is that it's a big barrier. It's like a wall. Nobody really wants to walk under it. It's creepy. It's imposing. It separates neighborhoods from one another. So if you get rid of that, if there's no highway that's visible, if it's all underground, then it reconnects the city, reconnects the neighborhoods, and that's why people like it. That's why it's a good idea. I think it's worth that amount of money to fix one of the major, major problems that Hartford has had ever since the highway was built.
The people of Hartford might like this, Colin, but the people who probably hold a lot of the control in the legislature, people who might hold the funding control, probably don't want to shut down the highway for as long as it would take to build a tunnel, and it's probably going to cost a heck of a lot more. Do you think there's any life to a tunnel proposal still?
I don't know, but I mean, I've never understood the other proposal. In other words, I've never understood dropping the current viaduct to grade. How that works. I mean, to me, it's going to look like, you know, the cross county or something like that. It's just how you have a highway at the basic road grade and have it not be a bigger problem. And the way that Susan's talking about the creepy part now becomes just a complete obstacle.
They're talking about it in a trench of sorts, but again, there's still the highway noise. They're still going over. I mean,
it's going to divide neighborhoods the way that it does. You know, no matter what you do in that way. You know, I don't know. I whether you can get the money for the tunnel, I have absolutely no idea whatsoever. But it probably is the best alternative if you take the price tag off.
You know, I think another thing to remember in looking at expanding highways and building more lanes on 95 through Fairfield County, and we all know from Robert Moses and all the highways that he built through New York City, if you build it, they will come. And you look at Fairfield County and you look at, you drive, you sit in the traffic and you look at three lanes, there's just gridlock. If you add another lane or two more lanes, it's just going to fill up. It's not, I mean, I'm not sure that's the solution. I think that, and I can't help but remember the gubernatorial campaign and Mr. Foley complaining about Mr. Malloy. He just wants to keep getting people out of their cars. Well, you know, that it has been a focus of the planning for this, and I think maybe that's a good focus.
Speaking of places that might be hard to reach by car, never really finished that roadway down to New London. So when we come back from a break, we'll be talking about the New London mayoral race with our friends David Collins, a columnist for The Day of New London, Susan Bigelow, a columnist for CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Joining us in The Wheelhouse today, David Collins from The Day of New London, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today at 1 o'clock?
We're going kind of high concept here. We're doing what I call the Pooh Show, which is about three different things related to that name. We'll start with the No Poo Movement, which has become a pretty big deal. People who don't think you should use shampoo for a bunch of different reasons, and so they have a whole strategy.
I didn't know this was a movement.
Yeah, it is. It actually is. See, Susan's nodding. She knows about this. Yeah, it actually is a movement. And so then we're going to go from, we'll jump over the middle segment and come back to it. Our final segment will be about Winnie the Pooh. There's actually some news about Winnie the Pooh. There's some new activity on Winnie the Pooh's part. And then our middle segment will be about the other kind of poo and these scientists who basically have discovered there's quite a bit of heavy metal in poo that shows up in waste treatment plants, including gold and silver. And they believe by extracting the gold and silver from poo, they can pay for some of the other stuff. You need to get all the vanadium and palladium out of it so you can put it on your asparagus patch.
There's a job.
Yeah. You literally.
Yeah, it's all about job creation, John. That's what I care about.
Literally would never hear a promo for a program like that anywhere else on the radio. It's the Pooh Show this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show, 1 o'clock. I also want to send out some congratulations today to the New Haven Independent. Our frequent guest and friend, Paul Bass, and his team have been covering the Elm City better than anyone. They're now entering the world of radio. WNHH launched this week, just today, as a matter of fact, on 103.5 FM for 12 hours a day. They've got a whole bunch of hosts from all over the New Haven area with amazing stories to tell and guests to have on. I'm very excited for Paul and his team at the New Haven Independent. Congratulations to WNHH. Today in the Wheelhouse, we're talking about a lot of things that are in the news this week. We spent the last few months discussing local elections for mayor in Hartford and Bridgeport. But since David Collins is here from The Day, we wanted to check in on what's happening in that city. So what's the race look like in New London right now, David?
Well, it's curious. You know, this is a fairly new thing for us. We had a charter change in New London. So the current mayor was the first sort of full-time strong mayor, the term is strong mayor, in a long, many, many generations. And this is, it's been an interesting cycle. He came out of kind of nowhere. He was a fairly recent resident of the city, young lawyer, ran as the outsider, won by a pretty wide margin, now running for re-election, still as the outsider. He was not nominated by the Democratic Town Committee, so he's petitioning to for a Democratic primary challenge, becoming increasingly progressive. He had been a Republican town councilor in Westerly. He's now been endorsed by the Working Families Party. He proposed and continued to support huge tax increases. 12% was his last proposal. His opponent came up with a proposal for a much more modest increase. He vetoed that after the council approved it, and then the council overwhelmingly overrode his veto. So very sort of unusual dynamic for an incumbent to be running as the outsider against the old guard. It just kind of burnishes his progressive credentials. He's appeared a few places and complained about Electric Boat and how the country's building too many submarines. I mean, that's the third rail of Eastern Connecticut politics.
Really is the third rail, isn't it? Well, I mean, there was a moment where it wasn't entirely sure he was going to run for re-election, right?
He said he was not. He was He was in the bunker, really. He was constantly there. So many things had been problems in his administration. He basically said that it had become such a distraction, the criticism, that he was not going to run for re-election. He was going to focus on the job at hand so that people could stop paying attention to how much they disliked him, apparently, as they said, he felt they were saying, and that he would take himself off of the table. And then, after, I think it was right after the gubernatorial election, he said, I'm back in.
So, Susan, you've been watching a lot of these local races. What do you make of New London? I mean, how does this maybe have any parallels to any of the other weird little races we see around the state this year?
I don't know. New London's sort of interesting all by itself because in a lot of these other races, you don't have a kind of clear ideological difference between Democrats, where it seems like you kind of do here.
Yeah.
It almost feels like the mayor is really almost trying to tap into national progressive ideas and thoughts.
Exactly.
I mean, didn't he endorse Bernie Sanders?
Right, he did, yeah. And that's an odd, in local politics, that's an odd stance to take, right? Because especially when you're talking about local property taxes, where people are so guarded about their taxes.
And again, for people who don't know New London, this is the smallest city by square miles of all of the state. And so with all of the services there, the state buildings, the various nonprofit buildings, the tax base of New London, David, not very big at all. So raising the taxes on the homeowners there is something that is maybe another little third rail.
Right. It's a huge club to get out and beat people. So it's hard to imagine which homeowners are going to vote for him. So you have to then depend on non-tax, property taxpayers, if that's what your strategy
is. But he could have a place in a Bernie Sanders administration, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if there's sort of a consistent theme, it really is about the difficulty of governing at the municipal level. So, I mean, in fact, here in Hartford, we have a similar situation where the incumbent is not the endorsed candidate, challenged kind of by the political machine itself. So a little bit like that. And, I mean, and the Bridgeport race is probably closer than one would expect for an incumbent with the kind of background that Finch has. And certainly nobody would expected Joe Ganim to be running strong at all in Bridgeport. But so a lot of this is about the difficulty of governing in an urban environment. It's just really, really hard right now. If there's another thread that you might see running through all this stuff, it's kind of, the state of Connecticut kind of parachutes into cities and then kind of, beams itself back out all the time. There's like a lot of meddling, but not consistent meddling. It's like maybe we're going to take over your Board of Education. Maybe we're going to get the NLDC going down in New London and some stuff with some really stupid ideas. And I mean, in city after city, often through quasi-publics and other stuff, you just see the state come in, meddle, screw something up, then leave. and so the person who's the mayor or the first selectman has to just, clean up the mess.
But you referred to this earlier, David. I mean, here's a city where, with the right type of appeal to the state government around Shoreline East, around a smart reconstruction of the highway system, which has also cut off that city. I mean, Hartford's not the only city that's been cut off by the highways. All of a sudden, you're looking at a type of, just a little gem with this port and all this activity around a few colleges down there, and you've got the casinos just down the road. It seems as though New London, with the right type of local and state investment, becomes this, this really cool place.
Right. Well, it's interesting because another thing, too, that's happening in New London that's very exciting is they're developing an all-magnet school system. We have a new superintendent, very qualified National Superintendent of the Year. He'd been actually named Boston Superintendent before he took a job as the Deputy Education Director in New York State, very, very qualified leadership in the school system now that's sort of developing this really interesting, innovative school system that should draw suburban kids back into the school system and make the city much more attractive. So that's one facet of, yes, all these interesting things that make New London kind of an interesting place for the state to kind of tinker because it's small enough where you can actually see maybe some things get accomplished too at the same time.
Since we're talking about southeastern Connecticut, of course, one of the big industries down there, as I mentioned, is the casino industry. And there's a new casino battle involving a company building a casino just north of Connecticut's border with Massachusetts. MGM has filed a lawsuit saying that it would be unconstitutional to limit a new casino off tribal land to just the tribes. Essentially, Susan, this is picking up on something that the state's attorney general, George Jepson, has already kind of talked about a little bit, that the state's plan to work with the tribes to build this new hurry up and build a casino along the I-91 corridor to siphon money away from the new Massachusetts casino might not actually pass legal muster.
Right. Yeah. And it might not. But of course, MGM wants to do everything that they possibly can to keep this thing from opening. Right now, MGM is actually delaying their opening in Springfield by a little bit because there's construction going on in I-91 in Springfield. And they want to make sure that that's all done before they actually open. So the threat of a Connecticut casino opening up first is actually much, much worse for them.
If they're going to wait until construction is done on I-91 in Springfield, it will never open. It literally will never open. But please continue.
No, and I think it will never open anyway. But no, it's true. So they have thrown an awful lot of legal money at this, and they may have a good case here. I think that they actually have they have something. I'm not sure how well it's going to hold up, but I think they've got something here.
Well, John, one term you need to learn is slot barns. That's what the MGM that's how they refer to the hastily whatever you call the hastily erected Northern Connecticut casino.
And a slot barn.
And Bill Hornbuckle, who's the MGM guy, whose name is fun to say, and he calls them slot barns, and that's fun to say. So these things are all fun to say. I kind of agree with Susan. I know in David's column he maybe saw it a little bit differently, and I. First of all, none of us are Lawrence Tribe here. You know, this is going to be a relatively complicated legal question. And had any of us gone to law school, you might have a better sense of sort of how it might play out.
Never just, stopped us before.
Right, exactly. So, but yeah, just eyeballing it, it kind of seems like an interesting legal question. Can you transfer that franchise, which was narrowly defined by the state Supreme Court in the first place, can you transfer that exclusive franchise from tribal land to just regular old private development land or something that's controlled by some other slimy quasi-public or something. I think it is. I would agree with Susan that it's an interesting question. I have no idea how it plays out in courts.
Go ahead, Dave.
Colin, I'm certainly not a lawyer either, but I look back at the track record here in Connecticut when the Pequots were running Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun had not opened yet. And the state decided they were going to have a new casino in Bridgeport, and they opened up the bidding, and they made the rules such that you had to, because they realized they would lose the revenue from the tribal casinos who pay for their monopoly. So if they open up a legal casino in Bridgeport, the legal operator of that casino would then have to make up for the lost tribal revenue. That was sort of the rules setting out. And it seems to me that if they set up some and did some kind of fast version of that for what they're planning for outside Hartford, it would seem to be this. No one challenged the legality of that. That gives everybody a fair playing field. That would seem to undercut the MGM argument that you can't just exclusively give it to the tribes because they'd have a right to compete. But the reality is that whoever opens it, they're going to lose that tribal revenue. So everybody should have an obligation to make up that.
Well, I think that one of the things that you mentioned in your column, though, is I think nobody believes that by opening up this new casino slot barn on the I-91 corridor to try to stave off competition from Massachusetts, that all of a sudden this creates a ton more revenue that just out of clear blue sky, that it creates a whole bunch of new jobs out of the clear blue sky. Essentially, the whole notion is that these are the tribes in the state trying to say, we want to protect our gambling interests in southeastern Connecticut, but just keeping the dollars in the state. This is really just keeping the money here, shifting it around.
Well, obviously, MGM is worried about it, and they think that this is going to be a problem, that this is going to stop money from coming up to their casino in Springfield. So I think that's the evidence that the casino and the tribes themselves have studied this, and they're the business operators. They think it's a good business model. So as Colin says, we're not lawyers, but we're also not casino managers, and it would seem that they have enough evidence to invest this much money that they feel it would keep some of the money back in Connecticut.
The big problem here is that the casino market is so oversaturated. There are so many casinos now. They're not as big a draw as they used to be. And that's why MGM is really, really worried about all this, because putting another casino anywhere near them saturates that market even further. And it just means that these revenues are going to keep falling.
I feel like Connecticut has these two existing casinos. They're big employers. We know that from our part of the state. These tribes think that they could compete with the Massachusetts casinos, which are clearly trying to take some of the Connecticut market. You're right. It's wholly oversaturated. I wouldn't want to invest in a new casino north of Hartford, but they do. And I think for the state, and in terms of problem gambling and gambling in general, I mean, we have the two of the largest casinos in the world. Is another slot barn or whatever they're going to put north of Hartford going to make a difference?
Thank you for saying slot barn. Susan's right that this in the 1990s, the casinos were absolutely unquestionably the goose that laid golden eggs. The problem with geese is they get older, they stop laying so many eggs. And that's what's happened here. The handle is down. The betting handle is down at the two primary sites here. So what we're really talking about isn't even really – we're talking about managing failure as opposed to pursuing success. The handle's going to go down. The slot barns are not going to solve that problem. They're more like a leaky plug to sort of stop some of that – that commerce from slipping out of the state. And by the way, it's not about jobs. It's about money.
It's always, if they say it's not about money, it's about money. Well, we'll end this actually hearkening back to the 1990s. The Hartford Courant's Dan Haar recently wrote about Donald Trump and how one of his earlier slurs against people, and he's had a lot of those recently, involved the Connecticut tribes. This is what Danny writes. It was 1993. Trump's target at the time was the Mashantucket Pequots, whose Foxwoods Casino and high-stakes bingo hall was less than 2 years old, but had already eclipsed the big hotels of Atlantic City and Las Vegas. Ears in quotes, "They don't look like Indians to me," Trump said to a congressional subcommittee inquiring about organized crime and policing in Native American casinos. Quote, "They don't look like Indians to Indians." This is Donald Trump dating all the way back to 1993. Some things never change. When we come back, we'll actually be playing a little bit more Where Are They Now? We're going to be looking at some former members of Connecticut's congressional delegation who all seem to be making news in one way, shape, or form this week. It's The Wheelhouse, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, Commissioner of the Department of Children and Families, Joette Katz, will join us in studio for the hour to talk about a new report about restraint, seclusion, and suicide prevention at the state's two locked facilities for youth. We'll find out how her agency has responded, and we'll take some of your calls. That is coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. And now it's time for Where Are They Now? And this is a game in which we're going to present our panelists with some former Connecticut congressional delegates and find out where they are right now. I think a pretty easy one to start is former Senator Joe Lieberman, back in the national political spotlight as an opponent to the Iran nuclear deal, named chairman of the group United Against Nuclear Iran, replacing someone who is actually supportive of the deal. The Iran nuclear deal was announced, Lieberman testified at a congressional hearing. Let's listen to a bit.
What began as an admirable diplomatic effort to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapons capability dissolved into a bilateral negotiation over the scope of that capability.
Are you surprised at all to see Joe Lieberman taking the national forefront now, outside of his role as senator, Colin, in railing against this deal?
Well, no. And so on David Letterman's old morning show, he had this conspiracy theorist who would like show photographs and charts and maps. And his overarching theme was that he could place Joe Garagiola at the scene of every American disaster. And you know, Gail Collins and I have tried to carry that forward with Joe Lieberman, where we feel like we can prove that everything that has ever gone wrong in America from like about 1995 forward can be traced back to Joe Lieberman. And so you'd think, well, that's over, you know. No, because really this is a very important deal. It's an incredibly important piece of diplomacy. And in fact, America's role in it is just such a delicately balanced one. So what's Joe Lieberman do? Trying to kill this thing, and I'm sure somebody here will point out that the reason he's taking over this group is the guy who was the head of the group
that's right.
Actually endorsing the deal now.
He's actually endorsing the deal now. Again, not a big surprise to see Joe Lieberman here, but it once again, it raises his national profile. We weren't exactly sure what Joe Lieberman was going to do in these years post-Senate, and now he seems to have found the exact issue that resonates with him, Susan.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And what Joe Lieberman likes to do a lot is to go on TV and complain about stuff that other people like. there's nothing in America that cannot be ruined by Joe Lieberman coming on and complaining about it. So that's where we are with him right now. I'm not surprised at all to find that he's popped up to do this.
So, go ahead, David. Yeah.
Just hearing his voice in that clip made me think how grateful we should be not to have to hear it all the time.
No. Now, so we're going to head down to your neck of the woods, David, where former Republican Congressman Rob Simmons has been endorsed now by the Stonington Republican Party for first selectman. He's currently on the board of selectmen. How's he done so far?
I would expect him to win, actually. Yeah. You know, we had a funny little kind of experience with our last first selectman in Stonington, and he ended up, we had some reporting recently, there was an FOI request for his BlackBerry. It turned out he was constantly sexting while in office.
We talked about this on the show. I mean, literally, it was almost an Olympic-level athlete.
Hundreds
in
a
his
day.
Ability to send sexual explicit text messages. It really was quite something.
Apparently,
what he was able
to do. Even during a conversation, a phone conversation with the governor, he was sexting with someone. And,
well, everybody does that.
It raises a whole different series of issues.
Professional level. So anyway, that's left this kind of, you know, he was a Democrat, and he put in place an administration that's now come under some criticism. And I think there's a sense in the town that the time to kind of turn the page and start over again. And, you know, you may not like Rob on a lot of national issues and international issues. And, you know, Democrats, it's a Democratic town. They might not normally pick a Republican. But, you know, it's who paves the road. And I think people feel that he's competent and honest. And I'd say he has a pretty good shoe in.
Well, and I think part of it, Susan, is, you know, how somebody like this is viewed in town versus on the national political stage. I mean, Rob Simmons, as a congressman, might say a whole bunch of things. But he's sort of just like the guy down the street who you might have a beer with and who probably wants to fix the roads and probably is viewed very differently in the town of Stonington than he would be if he was trying to unseat the 2nd District Congressman Joe Courtney once again, for instance.
Exactly. And the thing is that people in the 2nd District, including where I'm from in Enfield, they really like Rob Simmons. They like him as a guy. They think he's a good, honest person. They don't like a lot of the stuff that he believes. But as you remember from that 2006 race, he only lost by a little bit. And that was even holding a lot of positions that a ton of people in the 2nd District disagreed with because they liked him. Right. And so I think he could probably run for office in almost any 2nd District town and probably do pretty well.
Right. How interesting is it, though, Colin, to have someone who serves in Congress for a while end up running a small town? It's an interesting change. It doesn't happen all the time in politics, but it does happen sometimes.
It's kind of uniquely Rob Simmons, though. I mean, I think he really does want to serve. I think he's very sincere about stuff like this. I think we can guarantee that any sexting he does will be cloaked with state-of-the-art intelligence encryption devices. I mean, we're not going to wind up having to read this stuff. I just want to quickly say, because first of all, CTN, this is a show when former congressmen compete. You could do like a Superstars thing, you know, where they all have to like do races and fixed gear bikes and stuff like that. I mean, there's a lot of them out there. So just quickly, in the 2nd District, Sam Gagenson, I tracked down an article he wrote this summer about the plight of African refugees in the Mediterranean. And then Bob Steele, well, we're going to talk about Chris Dodd in just a second.
Yeah.
And then to round out the living 2nd District congressman, Bob Steele is actually one of the people who really is significantly opposed to Northern Connecticut slot barns and has been running around up in Windsor and places like that giving speeches about how dangerous and horrible slot barns are.
And let me just amplify something with Sam Gadenson. He's going to have a program on Paul Bass's new Paul Bass's new radio station, WNHH, coming up in New Haven. So there you go.
It all ties together.
Think about
this, CTN. This could be a ratings winner.
CTN, the Connecticut Network, is here taping our broadcast, perhaps for the last time. The last Republican congressman to represent Connecticut was Chris Shays. He later ran for Senate before losing to Linda McMahon in the primary. His name has been popping up as a supporter of presidential candidate John Kasich. He says when people see Kasich, they will see a normal human being, someone who isn't captured by the political environment. It seems as though his support sounds an awful lot like what people often said about Chris Shays, right? He's sort of the middle-of-the-road guy. He's the guy who's not extreme on either end. He's the sensible Republican choice, Susan.
Right, and how well did that work out for Chris Shays trying to run against Linda McMahon?
Even in Connecticut.
Yeah.
I mean, Chris Shays is someone who I wasn't sure, Colin, if we were going to see more of once he left Congress, and we haven't really along the way. I guess I kind of expected him to keep himself in the spotlight.
You know, he tends to kind of weigh in weird ways. Like, you know, he had this really – if you remember when Dick Blumenthal was being assailed by the New York Times about all the Vietnam stuff, Chris, like, weighed in this really unhelpful way. He kept pretending he cared about Dick Blumenthal and then just coughing up these just hairballs of – damning things that only he can remember. And here were the Kasich stuff. I mean, at one point he said he his eyes welled up with tears when he was listening to Kasich speak. I think it's like I don't expect him to be a significant player in the world of public policy, but I think he'll just sort of have these weird, highly personal reactions to things.
Okay, so now everyone knows how the game is played. Let's do this. We're going to see who can buzz in first. Where are they now? And the name is Gary Franks. There we go. Colin McEnroe.
One. All right. So actually, Gary Franks was last seen calling WNPR producer Betsy Kaplan to see if he could get on your show, John Yankoski. But just to back up. All right. So Gary Franks, African-American Republican out of the Waterbury area, served in Congress and then ran against Chris Dodd for Senate. And then, you know, he did sort of he really disappeared. And in fact, what he did was and Penelope Overton from the Republican American did this terrific piece on it in 2010 because it was in the Republican American. Nobody read it. But she did a great piece where she tried to figure out where he was. And it turned out he'd been in Maryland for a while, paths crossing with Ben Carson in an interesting way. First, in a very typical Gary Franks way, first he was like introducing people to Ben Carson because he knew him. Then I think he stiffed Ben Carson's hospital on some medical couple bills. He winds up in St. Lucie, Florida, where he's like using different names. His name is Gary Alvin Franks, but sometimes he's Gary Alvin, sometimes he's Alvin Franks. He's got all these different names. He's got a whole series of debts that he's either running from or not running from. So we sort of thought we wouldn't be able to find him. You were doing a show on Black Republicans, and Betsy Kaplan did reach him. It turns out he's back. He's back with a new book called, get your pencils out now, With God, For God, and For Country, Because We Can Do Better, which obviously Stephen Colbert helped him with his title. And so that's where he is. I mean, I guess he's sort of back. I mean, he really did have like a whole series of fairly large debts. And sometimes, I think even when Penelope Overton from the Republican American would call someplace, he would kind of leave. The way that story read at the time anyway, like a call from the Republican American, they would just pack their bags and go someplace else. So, but I guess things are better now. So, you know, I mean, America's the place of second chances.
One of the men who unsuccessfully challenged Franks for his job in Congress was Toby Moffett. Now, Moffett served in the House of Representatives from 1975 to 83, represented the now extinct 6th District. He's a staunch defender of presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, penning an op-ed for Huffington Post earlier this year about her. His name also popped up in an article from The Intercept regarding Morocco's influence with Clinton. Moffett served as a lobbyist for the Moroccan government. In part, it reads, a longtime lobbyist for the Moroccan government, Toby Moffett, penned an op-ed last month decrying the left-right tag team of pundits in the media criticizing Clinton's bid for the presidency. Records show that on December 24th of 2014, Moffett held a conference call with Dwight Bush, U.S. Ambassador to Morocco, concerning the Clinton Global Initiative event in Marrakesh next month. Even today, Susan, we're hearing more news about Hillary Clinton and what she's done with all these emails. This is sort of an interesting Connecticut tie to yet another thing about the Hillary Clinton campaign, in which we're going to continue to hear some of these trickles coming out about how people who are connected to her may or may not have been trying to gain influence either through the Clinton Foundation or through her directly.
Right, exactly. And the thing about the Morocco tie that sort of worries people, Morocco is this, the Kingdom of Morocco is the place where they're saying, oh, we're making democratic reforms. But on the one hand, they say this. But on the other hand, they are occupying this nation called Western Sahara. And they have been doing that since the 1970s, even though the people of Western Sahara, the few of them that there are, would really like them to go away. And they have rebuffed all calls for a referendum. They said, nope, it's going to be part of Morocco forever. Very controversial stuff. And so it's sort of interesting that Toby Moffett and now Hillary Clinton get sort of tied in with the slick PR campaign of Morocco. It's very interesting stuff.
And again, this is one of those interesting stories. I mean, the Moffett Group, Collins, has ended its relationship with Morocco last year, although Moffett still retained individually through the law firm Mayer Brown, where he works as a senior advisor. I mean, there are a lot of connections to the Hillary Clinton campaign, certainly outside of this one. Our own Bill Curry, who's on quite a bit, he's writing quite a lot about the Hillary Clinton campaign. He used to work for Bill Clinton in the White House. And is there anything that you see in this Morocco story at all concerning Hillary Clinton?
Oh, I mean, I do think it's sort of part of the whole that you're talking about. I'm impressed with how much Susan knows about Morocco. I'm guessing that one isn't going to rise as high as some of the other stuff.
There are a lot of tendrils to the Clinton Foundation, though, and you sort of wonder how many more of these threads are going to be pulling out as the campaign's going.
As a last one here, former Senator Chris Dodd has been head of the Motion Picture Association of America. In June, he signed a contract extension to 2018. His name has also been floated as a possible ambassador to Cuba. So he's got this seemingly cushy job at the MPAA. Do you see him going back into politics at all, David?
You know, the story about Cuba seemed like a perfect fit for him. I think he would really, if he's made enough money lobbying and is ready for that, I think that seems like a statesman role that he would really relish.
It's a statesman role he might relish, Colin, but it's one of those worries you kind of have about, here's somebody who leaves the Senate, he goes to essentially a big lobbying job, and then he goes back to maybe one of the most high-profile jobs in American diplomacy. It kind of sounds an awful lot like some of the issues that Hillary Clinton's been having in her State Department time.
Well, John, I'd like to make it a true Daily Double. I think it might be too late. I mean, first of all, Chris Dodd, in 2010, Chris Dodd made a lot of pronouncements about how he would never lobby. And then, like, with the next inhalation of breath, practically, he took this job overseeing a lobbying shop. I mean, he wasn't actually doing the lobbying. And then the next thing you know, I mean, he's on the Despicable Morning Joe lobbying against lobbying for the Stop Online Piracy Act. You know, I'm wondering whether he can really sort of get his cred back as a statesman after everything that he's done.
And meanwhile, The Guardian has reported that Google, Facebook, Twitter, and Yahoo have accused U.S. film studios of attempting to resurrect that Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA. We'll find out more about that later. Colin McEnroe, Susan Bigelow, and also David Collins, thanks for joining us in The Wheelhouse.